Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party candidate for president in 2020. And this Green Socialist Notes podcast is about continuing to advance the eco-socialist program that Angela Walker and I ran on. And so I'm going to say a few words at the beginning, and then we'll take your questions and your comments. So I want to start by remembering Lanny Guinier, who died yesterday. And some of you younger folks may not know who she was, but I think she's somebody we should remember and study her writing. She was head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in the 1980s, and she was a real visionary because she championed proportional voting systems as the best remedy for the underrepresentation of racial minorities in government. And it was a controversial position at the time because in 1989, the Congressional Black Caucus cut a deal with George H.W. Bush's administration to trade more black majority districts in the South for more Republican majority districts in the South after the 1990 census and redistricting. And the result was a whole lot more Republicans in Congress, and the majority in 1994 with the rabid right winger Newt Gingrich becoming the speaker. And Guinier pointed out that we can do better than to set up majority-minority districts with proportional voting, which would be better for black and progressive politics than gerrymandered black majority districts. And she argued that with proportional representation, you could have cross-racial pro-justice alliances instead of the segregation of white politics from black politics that limited the number of black representation you could have, representatives you could have in the House or a state legislature or a city council, and also isolated progressive whites in conservative and racist white majority districts where they had their vote didn't count. And the same with black people in those districts. So she had a very sophisticated argument and it cut across the grain, but I think it was important. We can see the results today. And she was nominated by President Clinton to be the head of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. But the Wall Street Journal started and all the Republicans piled on. They smeared her as quote unquote the quota queen, which was a big lie. She was saying majority minority districts were the quota, a limit, a ceiling, and that black political influence and representation would be greater with proportional representation. But in the face of those smears, Bill Clinton, who had no guts, no spine, no backbone, dropped Guinier like a hot potato as the nominee for the Civil Rights Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Justice. And that was typical of Bill Clinton, you know, triangulation that he practiced with the Gingrich Congress, which was coming. And that's how we got the repressive criminal justice reforms of that period, the elimination of the federal guarantee of welfare, corporate controlled trade agreements like NAFTA and the WTO, and all the other stuff that Clinton got past the Republicans wanted, but he was able to carry it across the finish line because he basically cut deals with the Republicans and took his progressive base for granted. And maybe that's what we got right now with Biden. So, you know, Lanny Guinier was often at the top of the list of potential green presidential or vice presidential candidates in the 1990s and 2000s. And she was contacted, she declined, but I don't think that diminishes at all the contributions she made to our thinking about how to do fair elections that promote racial justice. So I hope people will remember her and look into, you know, what she wrote. She wrote a book on the, you know, need for proportional voting and a book called The Tyranny of the Majority. She also took on the reproduction of our class and race hierarchies in The Tyranny of Meritocracy, which exposes how the so-called objective meritocratic standards advantage the advantaged and disadvantage the disadvantaged. And she also has a memoir called Lift Every Voice, in which she deals with, you know, what happened to her what Bill Clinton did when he dropped her nomination. So I hope people will remember her. And she left early at only age 71. Apparently she had Alzheimer's. So I'm certainly missing her and the contributions. I actually wrote a little bit about her when I was writing about election reforms in the long version of an article that was published in Tempest. It's on our website if you want to look for that. So meanwhile, bringing back to the presence, Schumer, the leader of the Senate, has said he's going to bring a proposal for a rule change to the filibuster by January 17th, the day we're celebrating Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. But this is a situation where Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema have signaled no willingness to support filibuster reform. So it's doubtful that he's going to get movement in the next 10 days that he hasn't been able to get in a year. And to go visible and public now seems it's a lot too late. And meanwhile, you know, McConnell, for probably devious reasons, proposed that instead they reform the Electoral Count Act of 1887, which set up the situation where there could be objections to slates or multiple slates sent in. And it sets up a procedure for dealing with them, but it's not clear and enables the possibility of a stolen presidential election. So the fact that McConnell opened that door, Schumer shut it closed right away. Given that the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act have no prospect of passing unless they get filibuster reform, I think Schumer should have said, okay, let's see what we can do with that. If no one wins a majority of the electoral votes, if their slate's objected to, then it's thrown into the House, where it's one state, one vote. And the Republicans control the most state delegations, and that's biased toward small, rural, overwhelmingly, you know, white America, those states. And what they could do is make explicit and limited the ability of Congress to challenge or reject electors, except in obvious cases of voter fraud or fraud by the state legislatures that send the electors or the governors. So it would seem they ought to pursue that. And if they could get bipartisan support for that, maybe they could deal with parts of the voting rights and election protection provisions in the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. And, you know, rather than say, we're not going to deal with the electoral reform or the Electoral Count Act, they should say, we'll deal with that too. And, but apparently they're not. So voting reform, election reform is going nowhere. Like Build Back Better, you know, there's an article in the Washington Post today saying Manchin, who offered a counter proposal when he said no to the Build Back Better that came out of the House, said, okay, we'll do universal pre-K funded for 10 years so it's permanent. We'll put some money into Obamacare and we'll accept the subsidies and incentives for renewable energy in the climate portion. That's better than nothing, but the Democrats didn't pick it up, and now Manchin's saying, I'm withdrawing that too. So Build Back Better looks deader than ever. And then the other thing I want to say a few words about is what happened yesterday in the Supreme Court when they heard these cases about the COVID mandates. Now, I think the first thing we need to acknowledge is that the mandates have worked to get the unvaccinated vaccinated. I'll just give you two figures that I had handy. State University of New York students have to be vaccinated to come back to school this winter. And out of 245,000, only 1,200 have not got vaccinated. That's one in 200, or about 0.5%. That means, you know, if they are like the general population, about 40% of them got vaccinations because of this mandate. Same thing with healthcare workers, Mayo Clinic. They fired 700 workers. At least I saw the report this week, but they have 73,000 employees. That means 1 in 1,000 refused to get vaccinated. So, you know, people say, you know, like I think I pointed out here, that Caroline Lucas, the Green Member of Parliament in the UK, voted against the mandates that Boris Johnson put forward, saying we'll have more luck persuading people to get vaccinated than forcing them to, which will build resistance. But I think these figures we just showed you, at least in the United States, show that the mandates work. But in the middle of this pandemic, where we've had on some days this week over a million new cases, the hospital ICUs are full. They got people being taken care of in waiting rooms and even out on the street trying to get into the waiting room who have serious COVID because they're just overwhelmed. With this going on, the justices seem to be coming out against OSHA's vaccine or test mandate for large employers, employers over 100 employees. And if they reject this, and they're going to make a decision within a few days in all likelihood, it's bigger than just the COVID mandates. It's really all regulations that are done by agencies under congressional legislation. The Supreme Court is basically saying you got to go back to Congress and have them write the details of these regulations. So it's not only going to affect OSHA, but Environmental Protection Agency, Securities and Exchange Commission, affecting the stock markets, consumer product safety, gun regulations, workplace discrimination, agriculture, aviation, federal FCC, radio and television regulation, federal elections, carbon emissions, fossil fuel infrastructure, even the licensing and inspection of nuclear power plants. There's an article, and I'm going to put it in the chat, the link to it, by Kimberly Whale in The Atlantic this week. And the title is "The Vaccine Mandate is About So Much More Than Vaccine Mandates." And I urge you to read that because this is very serious. The Supreme Court has really become like the super legislature. And they talk about being strict constructionists and the literal word of the original Constitution. That's such a crock. They're about to legislate the elimination of the federal government in a lot of ways. And that could have dire consequences for the kind of thing Greens want to see the federal government do. So the court's expected to rule within a few days, be looking for that. You know, this week, be watching to see if there's any movement on filibuster reform and election protection. And, you know, it's not a good situation, but all we can do is speak up, speak out, and fight back. So I'm happy to take your questions. And I'll get that link up here. I just put the wrong link in the chat. There we go. That should do it. Scout Trooper 164, what are your thoughts on the working class quitting jobs and refusing to be treated like garbage? Yeah, I say, you know, right on, more power to you. You know, there were a lot of quits in the last month, record highs, but it looks like people are quitting to get better jobs. And they're not taking crap from management who, you know, has felt like they can treat their workers like they got nowhere else to go. Well, now they got somewhere else to go. Unemployment is relatively low. And so I think that's a good situation that we should celebrate and do it ourselves if the opportunity presents itself. You know, take this job and shove it and get a better job. Scout Trooper 164, Howie, what do you think of the GOP entering a civil war with Trump endorsing those who backed up his lies? It's a real problem. I mean, the GOP has become authoritarian, anti-democratic, and you've got some of their leaders talking openly about civil war, which was, you know, the white supremacist far right's fantasy until recently. It now seems to have been taken up by a Republican Party that has made a fetish of guns. And, you know, you've got I forget the percentage right now, a high percentage of Republicans thinking that we need violence to, quote unquote, take back our government. A majority of Republicans believe the 2020 election was stolen, even though there's no evidence for that. There was no massive fraud. Most of the little bits of fraud here and there were Republicans trying to vote twice or vote for their, you know, dead grandma. So, yeah, there was a little fraud, but it had no impact on the outcome. Yet, you know, on January 6th, Trump's statement saying the real insurrection was on November 3rd when the election happened. So I think, you know, this is a dangerous situation. That's why voting rights and election protection legislation is so important. And the Democrats, you know, as I've said it, the Republicans are ruthless and the Democrats are feckless. It's been a year now, and they can't get what was their top priority, H.R. 1 and S. 1. What was it called? The For the People Act. And they shrunk that down to the Freedom to Vote Act after bipartisan negotiations with Manchin in the middle of it. And they can't get that passed. And that means they got to change the filibuster. And right now, Manchin Sinema are holding out. And unless something happens this week, we're going to go forward with all this happening at the state level, where the Republicans are not only making it harder to vote, particularly for racial minorities and low-income people, but also they are taking over the election administration so they can count the votes they want to count and dismiss the votes they don't want and certify, if it's a Republican who lost an election, certify that they won. And they're doing that in some of the states, and that's setting it up where they could do that in the Congress when the electoral vote is counted in 2024. So I take this threat seriously, and I think we all should. John Ralston, should we advocate for outpatient treatment for COVID in the spirit of harm reduction to keep people who won't vaccinate out of the hospital and save lives without the tribal vaccination war? We don't have the resources to do outpatient treatment for COVID. We don't even have enough resources to do inpatient treatment. We have underinvested in our healthcare system, particularly our public healthcare, you know, the public health systems. So I don't even know how that could be implemented. And, you know, I think what we need to do, I mean, we called for during the 2020 presidential campaign, still call for Medicare for all, sufficient investment to expand the healthcare system so we can take care of people when we have crises like this pandemic. We need more doctors and nurses. We need to train more. And we've enabled the AMA and, you know, professionals to keep themselves scarce so they get super high salaries when we actually need more doctors. More doctors per capita. A poor country like Cuba has many more doctors per capita than we do because they prioritize that. That's not to say everything about Cuba is great. I have criticisms of their political system, but their healthcare system puts ours to shame. And that's despite these sanctions we've imposed on Cuba. So I don't think outpatient treatment, I mean, unless you mean just go home and do the best you can, because we don't have the ability to, you know, send doctors and nurses out to treat people. How do you intubate somebody at home? We don't have enough of these antiviral drugs, and two of them don't work on Omicron out of the three that have been approved. So we're in a healthcare crisis, and I don't think, you know, treating the unvaccinated differently, you know, you say maybe that'll lower the temperature of the tribal vaccination war, it'd probably heighten it, because the unvaccinated wouldn't get equal treatment. So I feel you, because I'm mad at the unvaccinated too, but I don't think that's the solution. Armin Zeri, is there any advice you can give to the water protectors in Hawaii facing a stubborn U.S. Navy and its catastrophic pollution? Yeah, I've got cousins in Hawaii on Oahu that are affected by this. And I don't have any particular advice. I would say, you know, raise hell. And shame your elected officials representing you. The military is the big industry in Hawaii, along with tourism. And the Democrats really run that state, and they're very pro-militarist. So they are reluctant to criticize the military. I don't know why. I mean, strategically, the port at Hawaii is, and it's in the base for other branches of the services midway into the Pacific, is not something the U.S. is going to leave because, you know, the people of Hawaii are giving them a hard time. So I think they should put pressure on their representatives to Congress. You know, Schatz and Hirono, and can't remember all their names, but yeah, that's a serious problem. It's threatening the whole water table in Oahu. The Revolution Continues blog. Do you feel this is the year for Medicare for All or similar single-payer health care to be enacted? Possibly in some of the states. I'm most familiar with New York. We have a Democratic majority, a supermajority, veto-proof majority in both the House and the Senate. The Democrats promised that if they got that majority in the Senate, we would get the single-payer health care plan, which is called the New York Health Act, passed. But since they got the majority, they haven't even got it out of committee. The Assembly has voted for it many times since the early 1990s. And the plan has been improved, you know, with all the hearings and experience and research over the years. But I think, you know, we're gonna get it in some states before we get it in Congress. I mean, damn, you know, Joe Biden ran against Medicare for All. And of course, the Republicans are against it. So right now, the prospects at the federal level are poor. That's why we need the Green Party, and we need to run our federal candidates to call for an improved and expanded Medicare for All system. As we advocated during the presidential campaign, it should evolve into a national health service where all the medical facilities, hospitals, clinics, and so forth are under public control, public ownership, and the doctors and nurses and other healthcare workers are public employees. With community control, where we have local elected health boards to make sure the allocation of resources is rational and fair in the healthcare board jurisdictions. So I think in some of the states, I'm trying to remember, you've had Hawaii, you've had California, you've had Vermont, and you now have New York, where the Democrats had both chambers of the legislature and the governorship. And they were in the legislature, they were for Medicare for All until they had the power to enact it. So, but I still think we can get it through a big state like New York passing it and showing how well it worked, I think would be a big boost to the national movement for single-payer public health care system. So this year in New York, I don't know. The governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, just came out with her State of the State address. She did not come out for the New York health plan. Her progressive challenger, Jemani Williams, has a statement on his webpage that he's for a, you know, free public health care system that is culturally competent, but he doesn't reference the bill in the legislature. So I'm not sure if he's really going to come out for that and campaign on it. But the Greens are. So, like I've been saying, that's why we need a Green Party. Leslie Bailey. We need to switch the United States to the metric system. Do you think support for the metric system is growing in the Green and Democratic parties? Should we be protesting for the metric system? Being math was my favorite subject in school, which is strange for a lot of people, I would prefer the metric system. And there was a time when I was probably around junior high school where they were actually seriously considering it. I think it was then, maybe it was a little later under Ford. I can't remember exactly. And they decided against it. So I'm for it, but I think we got higher priorities right now. You know, voting rights, climate, healthcare, housing, all these COVID era supports from the federal government, like enhanced employment, unemployment benefits, the child tax credit, the moratorium on evictions. All these things are running out. So, yeah, I favor the metric system. It would be smart, I think, for us to join the rest of the world. But should we be protesting for the metric system? I think it's a little bit lower on our priority list than some of these other things I mentioned. But, you know, I appreciate the fact that you brought it up. I think, you know, it's something, if I get asked, I'm for it. Scout Trooper 164, Howie, what are your thoughts on people like Ben Shapiro complaining about California enacting a law where stores need to sell gender-neutral toys? I first of all question whether such a law actually passed, or the way it's phrased. And Ben Shapiro is a, you know, bomb thrower. He's a right winger. He likes the cultural wedge issues. So no, he'd be, if he wasn't complaining about that, he'd make up something else to complain about. So I don't know what a general neutral toy is. You know, I'm just thinking a doll. So do we then deny that there are boys and girls who identify that way and just have people that don't identify with one or the other gender in your toys? I really doubt they passed a law like that in California. Maybe somebody can enlighten me here, but sounds like a made up cultural issue, which is what the far right does. Get us all wrapped up on these tangents. And so we don't talk about the real issues we're facing. Austin Jones, can you tell about any Green Party candidates that you are excited about running? Well, there are Green Party candidates all across the country. Luis Rodriguez for governor in California excites me. He's a longtime activist, and I think he was poet laureate of California. But I'm excited about what we're going to do this year in New York. I don't know who the candidates are yet, but we are going to have to fight to get our ballot back. The former governor Cuomo, who resigned in shame, one of his shameful acts was passing the most restrictive ballot access law in the country. To get our ballot line back, we got to get 45,000 signatures in 42 days. That is harder than any state in the country. And then to retain the ballot after we petition onto the ballot line, we need 130,000 or 2%. And it's always 2%. I mean, in 2020, it was 173,000, was 2% of the vote that year. And, you know, we came up short, so we lost our ballot line. So that's what I'm excited about. You know, whoever the candidates are, both for the statewide slate, we need the standard before was 15,000 signatures and 50,000 votes. So they basically tripled the requirements, which were pretty hard to begin with. And then they have a distribution requirement for the petition where you got to get 500 signatures in half of the congressional districts, which is the way they usually knock off statewide ballots, by failing to meet the distribution requirement, because you have to document where those 500 signatures are. It used to be 100 signatures in half the congressional districts, so they increased that requirement fivefold. And this is all designed, I think, to get the Green Party off the ballot. We're the party that got 5% in 2014 running against Cuomo when he wanted to run up the vote, get more than his father, Mario Cuomo, ever got. More than he got when he was first elected in 2010, to lay the groundwork for running for president. And here the Green Party was sitting with 5%. Anybody who knows Andrew Cuomo knows he was steaming and mad about that. So that's why he got this shameful law passed and why we've got to overcome it. We're also going to lobby for a bill to bring back the old standards, 15,000 signatures and 50,000 votes. Hopefully get that passed before the petitioning starts on April 19th. We'll see if we can get the so-called Democratic Socialists and Progressive Democrats in the state legislature to get on board with that. The bill is actually coming from a Republican. So we'll see. But that's what I'm focused on and excited about in this election. The Revolution Continues blog. Are there enough Americans who want change to overthrow this corrupt system? Well, if you look at the public opinion polls and what people prefer for policy, they prefer what the Greens are talking about. You know, we were calling for a Green New Deal. Overwhelming support. Biden and Trump were against it. Same with Medicare for all. Same with cutting the military budget and putting more money into social and environmental protections. Same for student debt relief. Biden called for a little bit. We called for, you know, complete relief. And now Biden hasn't done anything, even though he promised to do something. So I think the majority of Americans are with us on those kind of reforms. I would say the majority of Americans, particularly on economic class issues, they're social democratic, they're or New Deal liberals. They support these progressive policies. Now, change to overthrow the system from capitalism to some form of democratic socialism, I don't think most Americans see themselves in that way. They're more concrete on the issues, not so much on the ideologies and the isms. So I think, you know, the majority of Americans are progressive. And now I'm thinking, well, what about those right wingers who want to overthrow this system, which they see as corrupt? And I don't think there are enough of them. Let's put it this way. They are a minority. And if we, the majority, let them change the system with the kind of laws they're passing in the states and also the violence they're using right now, they're intimidating election administrators. I saw a figure today that 1/4 of all people that work on elections are planning to retire before 2024. So you've got, you know, groups like the Proud Boys showing up at school boards, harassing election administrators because they're honest administrators. That's the change or the overthrow I think we got to watch out for now. So, you know, we're really in a situation where what the majority of the American people want doesn't get translated into public policy because the system is biased toward the Republicans. You know, the Electoral College, the Senate give extra votes, extra weight to the small rural states. Republicans have been gerrymandering the hell out of state legislature and House districts, especially since 2010. So they have disproportionate representation and are trying to now fix it so their minority can rule from a minority position. That's really what we've got to fight. So I think there are enough of us progressives, a majority, if we can get our will enacted. And then we got to watch out for this minority. It's a large minority that is willing to go to violent lengths to entrench their power. We're in a real turning point, I think, in our history. Kenneth O'Connor, should we put a national effort into getting at least one Green in Congress, wherever it may be most possible to break through the two-party first-past-the-post system? That has been proposed many times. I remember Barry Commoner, who had run for president with the Citizens Party in 1980, proposed that the Citizens Party do that in Vermont, where Bernie Sanders had just been elected mayor of Burlington, Vermont, the largest city, and other people who were Citizens Party members were elected to the Burlington City Council. And all the Citizens Party people all over the country said, no, what about us? You know, we don't want, we want to work in our district, in our city, and not, you know, go off to Vermont or send all our resources to Vermont. So you've got that problem. Second thing is, I don't see any congressional district with a very strong Green candidate that at this point poses any threat to the major party candidate who controls that district. If there was one, I think we can put a priority instead of all our eggs in that basket, but emphasize to Greens all over the country, here's a candidate that's running a competitive election, could possibly get into Congress, you know, basically send money or even go there and volunteer. You know, I can see that. So would that be a national effort? Okay, I'd agree with that. I just wouldn't make it the thing that are the centerpiece of our strategy. I think the centerpiece of our strategy is to keep building strong local green parties that can win local elections and on that basis, state ledge and House seats. But we got to build a mass base at the local level before that even becomes possible. So we have the boots on the ground, the grassroots organizers, the legs of the campaign, and enough people who, with many small contributions, can build a campaign war chest that is sufficient to be competitive. I think that's the approach we should take. And if anybody in any particular district gets to the point where they're competitive, yeah, every Green in the country should at least give them a contribution. Scout Trooper 164, what are your thoughts on the hypocrisy of the mainstream media demanding teachers to work in person and not broadcast remotely while mainstream media can broadcast remotely? Yeah, this is a big issue, and I'm really pissed off at so-called left podcasters and commentators like Jimmy Dore and Max Blumenthal in the Convo Couch saying the working class is rebelling against these vaccine mandates. No, the working class, first of all, you know, AFL-CIO and some of the major unions went to Biden and said he's got to do more to protect workers in the workplace. And we just had the case of the Chicago Teachers Union voting basically a wildcat strike. You know, Mayor Lightfoot in Chicago was mad, but teachers said it's not safe in the schools. So we're not going to work. We're going to teach remotely. In New York City, my former running mate for lieutenant governor when we ran together in 2018 for governor and lieutenant governor of New York, Gia Lee, she's been outspoken on this. She's part of the Moore Caucus, the Progressive Caucus, and the Teachers Union in New York City. And they're saying, we need more testing. We need more personal protective equipment. We need better ventilation. We need a safe workplace. And it's not just the teachers. I mean, you're getting from, you know, basically the CDC. They seem to have capitulated the business that says, we want our workers back. Make them come back sooner. So instead of a 10-day quarantine, if you're infected, now it's 5 days. And then you're supposed to test yourself, which is not reliable. And with the employer threatening your job, you're kind of forced back to work, and that's going to spread the virus. So, you know, the working class is demanding safe work, and these OSHA standards are being phased out, except for the vaccine and testing mandate that Biden urged. But the personal protective equipment and those kind of things, those were temporary, and they're phasing out this year. And that is wrong. You know, if anything, in relation to the COVID and the mandates, the workers are demanding more, not less, or saying it's an imposition on their workers' rights. Only people that haven't been workers can think that. I mean, I used to work at the hub of UPS, you know, unloading packages off trucks, usually two of us in the truck, breathing heavy. It's hard work. I've talked to my former workmates out there. Over half of them have got COVID over the last 2 years because UPS isn't really providing a safe workplace. That's what, you know, those people are talking about these mandates being an imposition. They want UPS to do more, and they're not. And that's the kind of thing that should be mandated. That goes back to that Supreme Court hearing yesterday. You know, they may cripple the ability of the federal government to set any of those standards. So, you know, the right wing's argument is, well, you can do it in your states. Well, we're going to end up with, you know, states like New York maybe having higher standards and states like Mississippi having no standards. And then what's business going to do? They're going to play off Mississippi against New York, say, cut your standards or we're leaving. That is not a good policy in the public interest. So, yeah, and the other thing about the mainstream media, they're giving voice to Mayor Lightfoot, who wants them to go back to work, or Mayor Adams in New York City, but not to the teachers. I could give them references. I could give them, Gia Lee can go on, you know, mainstream media. Jesse Sharkey, the president of the union, I know him. He could be going on the media, but I haven't seen him. I've only seen the mayor saying, go back to work. It is a real problem. And of course, the mainstream media, as you point out, They can do all their stuff remotely, so they don't get it. Austin Jones, a general strike for 10 days would critically disrupt the logistics chain. Yeah, not a general strike, just a strike by the logistics workers. I mean, when I was at UPS, we understood that. Apparently, the union tops didn't. Because the last strike that UPS workers did was 1997. And the whole period I was working there, we were coasting on the contract that came out of that. And once UPS went on strike, the whole supply chain, the logistics chain was disrupted, and UPS came to the table very quickly to settle and conceded a lot to us. We just had a Teamsters union election, new leadership. There's a new contract to be negotiated next year. And the people that got elected say they're going to prepare for a strike if need be. That would be exemplary for the whole labor movement. Like the UPS strike in 97 was probably the most successful strike the labor movement conducted from, you know, 1970 to today for 50 years. And, you know, UPS and the Teamsters have a strategic position in the economy, because if the packages don't move, the economy stops. The problem for the Teamsters is FedEx has been out there non-union since Reagan time. And that's because they're regulated as an airline, which means you can't organize hub by hub. You got to have a national vote, which is hard for the workers to organize and win. And then you got Amazon coming on the scene, and the Teamsters say they're going to organize them. We got a hub coming into this metropolitan area. And I, you know, if the Teamsters get serious about organizing that, I will do all I can to support them. But yeah, you know, logistic workers, in other words, trucking and package delivery, have enormous power, and they haven't used it. And Austin adds, shame long-haul truckers aren't allowed to strike because of the NLRB. Yeah, well, shame that the trucking industry was deregulated under Carter. You know, we tend to think of the neoliberal term coming from Reagan, but a lot of it started under Carter. I can tell you about things Johnson did, like eliminating the Postal Bank, a public bank that helped people that couldn't afford to get into commercial banks. Or instead of when the Fair Housing Act passed and they committed to building, I think it was 2 million new houses or something like that, the affordable housing units, instead of doing it as public housing, as they'd been doing since the 30s, they decided they were going to subsidize private developers to build affordable units. And that was the beginning of privatization. In the case of deregulation, you know, truck drivers today are lucky to make $50,000. A lot of times they got to own their own rig, and, you know, they have an accident or, you know, some traffic violations, their insurance goes up. Back then, the truckers were organized in the Teamsters Union. The routes were regulated. And they were making the equivalent of $120,000 today. It was a good job. Today, you know, truckers are really struggling. And that's why there's a shortage. It's not that great a job. It's dangerous. I think I was reading the other day that the average long-haul trucker who's got the Class A commercial driver's license lasts a year. It's such a tough job with such low pay and such high risks. What happened was when they deregulated, all these non-union trucking companies started up, and they undermined the union companies, and the whole industry for the workers declined. And just taking what I did in the warehouse, those guys were making $10 an hour for full-time jobs in the 70s. And then there was a sellout contract by the mafia corrupted leader at the time, Fitzsimmons. They cut the wage to $8 an hour. That was around late 70s, I believe. When I started unloading trucks at UPS in 2001, the starting wage was still $8 an hour. So that's a case where a regulated industry was working well. goods got there on time, the people working in it made decent livings. The companies, you know, they were making a profit, but they wanted more. And Carter accommodated them. And now truckers are in a difficult situation. Sorry about that. I should turn my phone off. I think this happened last week, too. Yeah, so it is a shame that long-haul truckers are in the bind they're in. Hopefully this new Teamsters leadership will begin to change that. The Revolution Continues blog. Has the CDC lost all credibility with its Delta Airlines decision to cut time from 10 to 5 days for recovering from COVID? Yeah, they lost some credibility. I wouldn't say all credibility, because that's what the anti-vax movement wants to say. The CDC is not credible at all. I think the research they report on in terms of the effectiveness of vaccines and the danger of, you know, variants that like Omicron is credible. But it's a shame that they caved in. Delta in particular was influential. I remember seeing Sarah Nelson, who heads the people that help work in the cabins with you when you're flying. I'm only thinking of the old name for them, but anyway, those people, she's saying this is directly pandering to business by the Biden administration, and it's not what the science, the public safety science, says we should do. So I'd say the CDC lost some credibility, but I wouldn't want to say they've lost all credibility, because that's what the people that are against public health measures are saying. And as we saw in the Supreme Court hearing that I was talking about, that feeds into the whole thing that we don't need federal regulation at all. So, but, you know, they're caving in to Delta Airlines is and other businesses is shameful. Scout Trooper 164, should Donald Trump stand for trial for having a Iran military commander assassinated? Asking because they want him to, or else they commit martyr's revenge. Okay, yeah, Iran is threatened for retaliation if we don't put Trump on trial for assassinating a political leader. There is grounds for that. Post the Church Committee in the 70s, where they found out the U.S. had been assassinating foreign leaders or attempting to assassinate foreign leaders like Fidel Castro many times, they passed a law saying that is not, it's against U.S. law. Yet that's exactly what Donald Trump approved when he was president. So, yeah, he should stand trial for that. I wonder where the hell the Justice Department is. You know, they're prosecuting the suckers who went to the Capitol to save the election from the steal at Donald Trump's direction. But the people that planned the whole thing, not just the, you know, attempt to bully Congress physically by going into the Capitol building, but all the planning for, you know, trying to get Pence to reject some state elector slates and force it into the House. You know, the memo, they had a PowerPoint. I mean, all this stuff has come out. And we know who the plotters were. You know, it was Donald Trump. It was Steve Bannon. It was that lawyer that wrote that memo. It was the, I think, Air Force or military officer that did the PowerPoint. I'm forgetting all the names. General Flynn was in there somewhere. I believe Roger Stone was in there. He's denying that now because I think he knows he's culpable and they may get to him. But where the hell is Merrick Garland on these cases? You know, this has been discussed and people say, well, he's keeping his powder dry and doing stuff behind the scenes. But if they were actually doing those investigations, they would leak out to people who have been questioned. And we don't have any evidence of that. So there's a lot of things Donald Trump should stand trial for. It may end up being for economic crimes here in New York, for basically bank fraud and tax fraud and insurance fraud. because he would sell those different entities different values for his property, sometimes hundredfold differences. So he could lower his taxes and, you know, raise his collateral for loans and so forth. So, yeah. Scout Trooper adds, the Iran threat worries me because China supports Iran, meaning Iran could give them a call to fight us. I don't think the danger is, you know, all out war. You know, Iran and China, I think, are smart enough to know that they don't want to get into a world war with the U.S. That just would not make any sense for anybody. But that won't stop Iran from, you know, hitting the U.S. where it might hurt. They already do that when they their militias in Iraq shell U.S. bases, and our ally Israel is shelling with missiles and drone strikes Iranian militias and assets, including Hezbollah in Syria. So this low-level, low-intensity warfare, as they call it, is already going on. And, you know, we responded, or Iran responded to the assassination of Soleimani by some, I guess, mortar strikes at U.S. bases. So, but when they warn like they did, they may be foreshadowing a bigger strike. On the other hand, it may be for domestic politics. The president of Iran made a statement as a right winger. He beat out the so-called reformer who had been in there before. So I wouldn't worry too much about Iran and China going to war with the United States. That would be suicidal for all of us. And I think China and Iran don't want to do that. But what might happen is, you know, these lower level strikes, probably in the Middle East where we have our troops based or stationed. Scout Trooper 164, what are your thoughts on New York City and LA being among the top three cities filled with homeless people? Well, we need a solution to the homelessness problem, which is immediately finding shelter for these people that is safe and sanitary. That means, for example, putting these people in hotel rooms that are going unfilled, partly because of the drop in tourism due to COVID. That's short term. In the long term, we got to provide more affordable housing. You know, a fraction of the people who are homeless have mental health and addiction issues that make it hard for them to maintain a place of living, you know, and pay the rent and get a job and so forth. They need, you know, social services help. But a large fraction of those people are just people that their wages are too low and they can't make the rent and they end up on the street, which means we got to build affordable housing out so that everybody can afford a decent place to live. And of course, that takes time to build that. So immediately find shelter for these people and shelter not being used. I mean, in New York, there are high rises full of penthouses that people all over the world have just bought as investments. You know, if you look at those buildings at night, there are very few lights on because there's nobody in them. Maybe New York City should do what Berlin said they wanted to do in an advisory referendum last fall, and that is expropriate the biggest landlords in Berlin and make those units public and affordable. Maybe New York City should do the same thing with some of these high rises that are empty. And that would be better than leaving these people on the street, because that's not a good place for anybody to be, you know, instead of being in a decent shelter. Scout Trooper 164, what do you think of Amazon workers dying during their shifts due to being denied medical leave? Asking since Secular Talk covered this. I'm not surprised that people asked for medical leave and were denied. We know that there were reports of Amazon workers there in Kentucky with tornadoes approaching, were told they couldn't leave. And they were in a flimsy warehouse that collapsed and killed a number of them. So if they're denied leaving for medical reasons, I'm not surprised. The workers should have left anyway. And if they died because they said, okay, I'll take care of whatever it is after the shift, you actually have the right to refuse unsafe work or be forced to work when you're sick. But our workers don't know their rights. I mean, that's something the labor movement should be teaching people, not just members of the unions, but everybody who works. So I think it's terrible that those workers died. And, you know, we need to improve. I mean, this goes back to the vaccine or testing mandates. And the other thing is there's not enough personal protective equipment and social distancing and so forth and ventilation in workplaces all over the country. That's why Omicron is spreading so fast. So that's another part of this that we need to do to defend workers at the workplace. The Revolution Continues blog. Some say Biden can cancel all student loan debt with a stroke of a pen. Is this possible? Why hasn't he done so if that's that easy? Yeah, he could do it. Something like, forget the percentage, 90-something percent of the student loans are held by the federal government. So you can cancel those loans. It would go on the debit side of the federal ledger. It would increase the national debt. But on the other side of the economy, the private economy ledger, there'd be, now they say $1.6 or $1.7 trillion. That would be on the ledger of those students, which would enable them to go forward. And as they earn money, instead of paying the federal government back the loans, they could buy houses and appliances and start having a family. A lot of them are postponing that because they're under the student debt burden. The remaining 7%, the federal government could take those loans over and also write them off. So it is possible. Why hasn't he done so? Well, it's not because it isn't easy. It's because he doesn't want to. He comes from Delaware, you know, which is where a lot of these banks incorporate because the regulations are so weak. And he's been a creature of the banking industry, the credit card industry, the financial industry, predatory lenders. So he knows which side his bread is buttered on. And he was responsible in large part for that provision in the bankruptcy law that passed in the early 2000s that exempted student loans from bankruptcy relief. So that's who Joe Biden is. That's why he hasn't done it. Not because it's hard, because he doesn't want to. Charles Canepa, and how would private companies get the punishment they deserve for driving the cost of education up so bad? Well, the private companies in a lot of cases are the private and public universities where they're empire building. They're not making personal private profits, although top administrators get very high salaries. They're building, you know, empires with bigger budgets and more buildings. And a lot of that doesn't have to do with classroom instruction. So a lot of that is driven by, you know, profit and nonprofit empire building or private and public empire building. And of course, there are private companies that like that, construction companies, they get to build stuff. Financial industry that gets to manage the investments of these high salaried administrators. So there are a lot of private interests going into driving up the cost of education. So that needs some regulation to make sure the investment in education goes to the students' instruction and you know, basic needs. And the other thing that tends to drive it up is the universities are competing, the colleges are competing for students. So they like to build fancier and fancier dorm and living facilities and student centers and extracurricular infrastructure. And so it becomes more about a lifestyle for the affluent rather than education for the masses. And so I think those are some of the forces that are driving up the cost of higher education. I assume that's what you're talking about. If you're talking about, you know, K through 12 or pre-K through 12, then you're talking about the charter industry, which is privatization of public education. They call them public charter schools, which is Orwellian. It's like saying Lockheed Martin is a, you know, a publicly owned public enterprise because it gets most of its money, from the Pentagon, the federal government. Sorry about that line. That's a landline. I can't stop the ringing. So that's a whole nother question. You know, the privatization of public education and all the scams and ripoffs that the charter school industry is doing. So yeah, private industry is looking for sources of revenue. There's $600 billion a year flowing through the public school system. And that figure is a couple years old. So that's why they're going there, to siphon some of that off for their private profits. And you know, what we advocate is that there should be tuition-free public education from childcare and preschool through post-secondary colleges and trade schools. And public education should be public. And that is an investment in our future that all of us will benefit from. Leslie Bailey, do you think H.R. 7120 will pass this year? Geneva, New York has experienced a senseless killing by police. We now have a police review board. Is 7120 the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act? Yes, okay. I don't think so. You know, they won't get rid of the filibuster. So you got to get, you know, Manchin and Sinema and the other conservative Democrats on board. It did pass in the House. It gets blocked in the Senate. And the filibuster seems to be more important than stopping police brutality, securing people's voting rights, and making sure the people that win elections actually get into office. And, you know, the Republicans are in lockstep against any of these reforms. That we understand. The Democrats are letting a few of their Democrats block the whole reform agenda of things like George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which has some good things in it. It won't solve all the police brutality problems, but you know what we've advocated is community control of the police. So they answer to the public and not themselves when there's questions of abuse. So I'm afraid, no, I don't think it's going to pass. They were trying to negotiate a compromise. You know, the guy from New Jersey, Cory Booker, and the guy from Georgia, the Republican, whose name I forget right now, and they couldn't do it. So I don't think it's going to pass, unfortunately. Okay, it's been an hour. And it's time to wrap up. So, like I said, watch this week. See if there's any movement on filibuster reform. If you got a representative, if you're in Manchin's, if you're West Virginia or Arizona, at least call those senators and say, you know, the voting rights and election protection are more important than a rule, a Senate rule. And then I would just say, you know, this COVID variant is, the Omicron variant is highly contagious. I hope you are up with your vaccinations and practicing, you know, getting a, now they're saying, you know, these old, you know, surgical masks are not good enough. You got to get the KN or N95 masks. I've been certainly going around with those. And, you know, take care of yourself. This thing's supposed to peak by the end of the month, and then we'll see where it leads. But, you know, I hope everybody protects themselves in this pandemic, and we'll see you next week.